crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
And we're back. Duct tape and baling wires. ZizRadio.com. So, sorry about the interruption there. Apparently somebody turned an extra something on in the other room and basically blew out the circuit breaker and shut me down. Shut me up. Made me silent, so to speak. I've been joined by Jermaine, and looks like Justin's in here too. So how are you guys doing this morning?
I'm fine. Just missing the boat with the Wimshurst.
I'd like to get a lot of people to go over there to Jermaine's experiment lab over there on YouTube and subscribe to this young man. He's really talented as far as I'm concerned. Posted a video over there. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html at www.shazizradio.com. And the link's posted in, looks like on the Awake side. And that's actually there's three chat rooms in one, doggone it. So, you know, you get a chance to talk to several different people. Anyway, I was really impressed with the construction of your Wimshurst there, Jermaine.
Wrong clue?
Anyway, basically the video we posted over there is, he's titled it My Wimshurst Powered Ball Cyclotron. It's pretty doggone neat. One of the things, I've been posting a lot of static electricity videos here because I think static electricity is kind of overlooked as far as what its actual capabilities are. I'm also doing some research in on, magnetism and static energy as well. Justin, you got any thoughts on that? Are you there? I think we done lost Justin. He usually has a lot to say on that.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, sorry folks, I just this whole breaker box kicking off every time you turn around kind of thing drives you nuts. I'm gonna basically put my whole entire show on solar and wind and a backup battery bank. That way the whole house could shut down and I'd still be on here jaw jacking. What do you think, Jermaine?
Yeah, that would be the best thing if we were having a economical breakdown.
Yeah, somebody like basically turns on one thing too much on these breakers. These breakers are set to go off, essentially at the lowest point, so that basically protection against fire. If the breaker breaks early, then you don't have to worry about your wires getting hot and setting fire to the house or whatever. So. On one hand, it's a good thing, but on another, it's obnoxious. Man.
Yeah.
Anyway, as I'm sitting here looking at your Wimshurst design, I'm thinking you did a really good job. Did you use some old records with that, is what you was telling me?
Yeah. I tried to make a Wimshurst using parts from around the house. And I first wanted to use some acrylic discs. But I didn't have the proper tools to make them perfectly round. So I thought of, what can I use then? So I thought of some old records. So I used records, yeah.
Well, that's a brilliant idea. And that's another thing. You get those parts pretty doggone cheap, especially over here. There's all kinds of old thrift stores and flea markets where you can find them old, one of those album size discs there.
Yeah.
I can't remember. They were like 33s and 45s back in the day, weren't they?
Yeah. I'm not that old.
They called them 45s with the little bitty ones with the big old hole in there, and then the 33s were the album size ones, I believe.
And what were the Bakelite ones? You know, those brittle ones, the first ones.
You mean the very first records that came out, the really hard plastic?
Yeah, that would break easily, yeah.
Yeah, you didn't want to drop those back in the day, but these are...
No, but those you had to play at a certain speed, not like the ones we're used to now. With it's not the vanilla plates, they need to spin at a different speed, I think.
Yeah,
quality was better though.
Those are vinyl, so they're pretty doggone durable, man.
Oh yeah.
It's fine.
But if you're going to use those records as discs, the advantages are that those discs are made from vinyl, but they have a lot of carbon in it to make it black, which is conductive.
Ah,
so
that's brilliant.
It wouldn't be as efficient, but hey, if you have nothing to
well,
use.
Well, one of the things that I like most about the deal is, number one, it's already got the centered hole in there. Did you have any problems connecting that to the shaft or anything on that?
No. The holes are a little bit too small for my shaft. I just enlarged them and glued two pulleys on them, either one of them.
Cool.
But yeah, that worked out fine.
Either way, trying to find the perfect center so you got a balanced wheel there, that's already helpful there, wouldn't you think?
Yeah. And another negative about having those blades is that they're very flimsy. They aren't as strong as the acrylic plates are.
Also, so, seeing that you made some Leyden jars out of some old, looks like jam jars there.
Yeah.
Hey, man, that's what I like the most about, especially, you know, when I first saw one of your videos, was the solenoid motor that you built, and I like the fact that it was made out of mostly recycled stuff. And see, that's the kind of stuff that impresses me, you know, thinking outside the box kind of stuff. But with this static electricity, also the cyclotron part of that deal, would you like to explain to people how that thing works?
Yeah, sure. So that WIMSUS has an output, and it has a positive and a negative. And there, in the round ball, there is a long strip that goes across. Let's say that's negative, and you have two shorter strips that are one and a half centimeters from the middle strip, so that they don't arc over, which in that one is positive. And you have a foil covered ball, and when that's when you put that ball on one of the strips, it gets charged, and you know that same charge is repelled, so it's being pushed. And it's being attracted by another strip, because different polarities attract, and the ball has enough momentum to push away and then turn. Yeah, so it's being charged, repelled, attracted, charged, repelled, attracted, and so on.
So essentially it's carrying from one plate the extra electrons and discharging and going on around in the circle there is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Just like magnets, that's the poles attract and repel.
Well, that's the part about it that I'm talking about, the, you know, some people would call it, I guess, electromotive force or attraction, magnetism. You know, I've been trying to do some research on to see interactions between magnets. See, with static electricity, it's more of an attraction than it is, like a magnet. You can break a magnet down into a whole bunch of tiny pieces, and all the tiny pieces will have a north and south pole. You see what
yes.
I'm saying?
Yeah.
But with static electricity, you got one specific, it's negatively charged with extra electrons, and so that charge wants to carry over and, you know, basically get rid of it, discharge on something else. So
yeah, just like it says, static.
Yeah.
It's electricity that stays, it charges a place, and it stays charged.
Well, I got to thinking about that some time back, and I thought about, you know, the holy grail of free energy as far as making like magnet motors and stuff like that would be basically to have a monopole magnet, you know, where it's only got one pole, and so since we know that, same like poles will repel themselves, then you'd get a constant repulsion without that attraction back whenever it gets past, the first magnet, you know, is when it's being repelled. Now it's on the opposite side, it's trying to bring it back the other way. That's where you get that cogging effect in your permanent magnet motors. But if you had a monopole magnet to where it would be just north or just south, it would continuously repel itself. And so, you know, as far as the alternative energy, the person could come down with a monopole magnet, or, you know, even like my buddy Thomas was talking about, being able to 3D print magnets to, you know, guide the flux wherever you want it to go, if you understand what I'm saying here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
With static electricity, it's almost the equivalence of a monopole magnet, wouldn't you think?
Yeah. It charges plates positively or negatively. So.
All electrostatic fields are developed between all charged bodies. Meaning if something is quote-unquote negative, you can add a charge to it. Right, so now that you add that charge to it, it does become unbound from the unitary system. Right, if we give ourselves positive and negatives on the Earth, right, when you give something a charge, it's like filling up a balloon. It now becomes unbound.
Did you know that any battery could become a magnet if charged with static electricity?
Yes.
Well, I'm just thinking that with static, you got some choices where you know where you can either, you know, positively charge it or negatively charge it and be able to guide that in directions. That force, whereas if you look at all these little atmospheric motors that people have been making and corona motors and stuff, they don't seem like they have a lot of torque. However, I have seen rimstar.org over there, Laser Saber, Laser Hacker, whichever, I can't remember. Anyway, he's made some pretty impressive static motors that they were self-starting and had a lot of torque. So that tells me that with a few modifications and different types of materials that you use, some of them, you know, like silver is really good at picking up static electricity. Do you know that?
Yeah, because you can look at the Tribio Electric series, I think. What's it called?
Tribal Electric Effect in different materials.
It's a list of materials which can accept electrons and give off electrons.
Yeah. Well, some of
transparent paramagnetic.
Is that it?
Well, yeah, I just have to define the word, right?
I thought she was getting ready to go into something. So,
well, there's lots of things I can go into. It's just that, like, I know Jermaine acknowledges or grasps what I would say about things. Not too many others do, right? It's hard for many men to come together and have correlations, right? It ends up in conflicts or debates, and that's why everything is theories in our modern science world, is because everybody's debating about everything, right?
Well, either way, some folks look at static electricity as obnoxious. You know, it's like, you know, rubbing your feet on the carpet and, you know, going over there pick up something, it just so happens to be metal, and you get that shock all the time. Or if you're working in the microchip industry, you know, you got to have a ground wire from your wrist down to to something metal, so that you're not building up a static charge and running whatever it is you're working on. You know, a lot of these sensitive microprocessors that they work on, and there's other things like that. You know, like static electricity has a tendency to attract dust. You ever notice that? They get those.
Right. Things. Yeah. It's the water within it that's being attracted.
Right. Right. Because it's oxidized. Right. It's an oxide dust. It has no. It's got the absence of water. So it's going to try to take on that water. So it's going to attract to wherever that water is pulling it to, because it's very porous and has those holes that can be filled up and retained. the water.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that it's really prevalent. There's static electricity is all around us. I mean, all these different molecules that we talk about are in different types of materials. The tribal electric, what's the word I'm looking for? The scale that Jermaine was talking about just a minute ago.
Tribio electric series.
Yeah. So there's different materials that, you know, some of them want to steal electrons, some of them are neutral, and so on and so forth. And I'm thinking that if you could get the right combination of them, you could get a pretty strong, force going on that you could actually use to get some really, some actual work done. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, but that's how generators made. There is one pulley made of it. Metal or a material, and the other one is made of the other material that gives away, and the other one is made from the material that accepts electrons.
Right, like Teflon and glass.
Yeah, Teflon and glass. Yeah, Teflon is negative, glass is positive.
Right, and then if you switch the pulleys, the top toroid or sphere, whatever you're using on top of the Van de Graaff generator, if you switch the pulleys, then you have different polarities. So one Van de Graaff generator will be producing a positive charge, and one will be producing a negative charge.
I wonder what would happen if you change the pulleys around with one Van de Graaff generator. So the top load of one is positive, and the top load of the other is negative.
You create a pulse between the two. If you take a metal ball and you stick it between the two of them, one will attract, one will push, bang, 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 it'll become a bell.
Franklin's bell, yeah.
Right.
Well, either way, you see that you can actually get some work done. I watched a video on YouTube just yesterday about the guy had some copper shavings, and he had some silver shavings, and he actually had some gold shavings, and you can see all three of the metals were affected, but it seemed to me that the silver was more effective. What do you guys think about that? You think it's possible to build like a static motor using, you know how they do the atmospheric motors using razor blades for the pickups or whatever? Well, imagine if you used something that would have a stronger effect to it, like silver.
Well, remember, I don't know if you've heard this, but Nikola Tesla once talked about his antennas, right? And that they had to be very shiny, right? And these are receiver antennas that are picking up electrostatics or electrics, however you want to put it for your own terminology. You can find the report, it's in there somewhere on Google. He said that the objects had to be very shiny. We know silver is a metallic element. It's very shiny. It can be smoothed out like granite. It's coarse, but at the same time, you can polish it, buff it, so that the porosity stays the same inside, but the surface area is completely smooth. Therefore, you get both effects. Porous would absorb it, but shiny would deflect it. So you get a push and a pull with it as well. A birefringent kind of nature.
Well,
I don't know if any of that made sense.
I'm thinking that you could actually build an electrostatic motor and that really seriously had some torque, after you do a little bit of mathematics and stuff like that and try to figure out which are the actual best materials to build this thing out of. But if you watch the doggone static motors run, you're actually getting work done with static electricity. Keeping in mind, once again, like the Corona motors and all that, they don't have a lot of torque, and it takes a lot of voltage to get that to turn. But nonetheless, it's still happening. You see what I'm saying? That force is still there, and I believe it could actually be made a lot stronger than what it is. You guys have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and static electricity isn't that hard to make. It doesn't cost much to generate static electricity. Like if you put a wire on
and high up in the air. Even then, you can you get static electricity, right?
Yeah, and that's, you know, just a mere fact of how the Van de Graaff and the wind service actually work. You know, Van de Graaff being more of a friction kind of deal.
Yeah.
And the Wimshurst, basically you got atmosphere up in between there. And it's actually interacting with the atmosphere between those plates as one goes in the opposite direction and actually has a little bit of friction too because of the pulley system that has different materials on there.
But and it separates the positive and negative charge.
Yeah, nonetheless, it don't take a lot of torque to turn that. You see what I mean?
No.
Okay, so German silver has a deflection of 88 degrees. It gives it the highest voltage, right? Deflection means, if you take a galvanometer, right, and then you hook up a battery to it, the needle would deflect away. You take the potential difference and it gives you your voltage. German silver has 88 degrees of deflection, so it would be the highest voltage output.
Yeah.
Well,
but the thing is, it's called German silver, but there isn't any silver in it.
Ha! Funny.
Yeah.
That's what they're saying. Well, it would be like brass or bronze, right? And have a mixture of a whole bunch of different things.
Yeah, it's an alloy. Yeah, like it's being described. Yeah, it's being described in the. Well, what's the book called,
Book of Daniel Davis.
Yes, Daniel Davis.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
He explains the ratio of metals, the amount of metals for the alloy.
Right.
Well, either way, it's like I said, when I'm watching that the ball cyclotron go around in circles, and I'm watching all these different atmospheric motors and static motors and stuff like that, I'm looking past the simplicity of that design and thinking how far you could actually take it, because like you said earlier, Jermaine, that static electricity is everywhere. I mean, it's probably the easiest to get going. Now, question is, how do you amplify that? You got any thoughts on that? Like, what happens if you took your Van de Graaff generator and you hooked it to an electric motor? You think that by speeding that thing up to some serious RPMs that you could raise the voltage up a lot higher?
No.
It has a certain limit how fast you can speed it to get the maximal potential out of it. And if you spin it faster than it doesn't make a difference.
Right.
Because it's happening.
There is a maximum of speed for a maximum potential, and if you go past it, you're just wasting more energy.
Right.
Because the output isn't getting... Yeah. The output isn't getting more, bigger, but you use more energy to get the same output. Well, if you slow your wheels a bit, you get the same output, because there is a limit on how fast you can speed it up.
Try give me an example with each plate, and each plate has a bubble, right? Everything has an atmosphere. We live on Earth and it has an atmosphere, pressure zones, right? There's a density to each aluminum plate or copper plate, brass, silver, whatever you're using, right? Gold. That bubble around, we don't see that unseen force. It's there. But when those two plates come together, the bubbles touch each other and they push outwards, going, and they pop going down the brushes. The bubbles get pushed inside, outwards, deflected from each other, because they're made of the same material, right? Water will conflict with water, right? And they get pushed down the brushes. The brushes act as diodes. When the plates leave each other, it takes the atmosphere, the geomagnetic field, to fill those plates back up. And if you're going so fast, they don't have that time to fill up enough to give you that maximum atmosphere amperage.
Makes a lot of sense, but in one sense, it's actually a plus that you don't have to spin it that fast. Like you said, you don't have to put very much energy into getting
it. Add another plate.
Yeah.
Yes. Like, you have those pictures Justin sent to me. They're multi-plate Fendigraph, no, multi-plate Wimshurst, Voss, or whatever you want to call it. And to, they were made to for medical purposes, right, Justin?
Right. Yeah, you stand.
You send
on
a certain pulse into your body, which
fills you up.
Yeah.
Because you're like these medical things, you would stand off the ground. You'd be on a platform, so you're not grounded. And then your head would sit in the top part of it, and they would put different sized capacitors on it, and they would spin it with a motor, and your body would fill up. When you, like, when we get shocked from the outlet, our heart beats boom, 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 boom. And when you put your finger in the outlet, it puts tension on that. It constricts it. It's called the Z-pinch or the alpha pinch. And it crosses your heart. And it stops your heart from its own muscle, its own tensions. Right? Your heart is going boom, 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 boom. It's own frequency, hertz, cycle, however you want to put it, right? When you're not grounded, it doesn't conflict with that. It just relieves pressure. It's pushing on the atmosphere. That's why when we stick a rod up in the air, we get a voltage, because it's potential difference. We're potential difference. And when we sit on a chair, we become unbound, and you can be filled up. And, you know, Tesla did this in bathtubs with sparks coming out of them. And even if you go high enough into the whatever hertz cycle you want to say, gigahertz, even higher, sound, infrasound, you can glow with being on the ground.
So if you got a multi-disc Wimshurst that has a whole lot of surface area makes a lot of difference when you're talking about Tesla coils and top loads and, you know, being able to build up a lot of energy onto that space, or even in copper wire where you're actually moving a lot of electrons, because in copper, there's 29 electrons in copper, the last one being loosely coupled, and it's that last one that we use actually to get our electricity moving. And so with that said, all the rest of them are pretty tightly bound in there. If there was a way to actually loosen up all the electrons in copper wire before you run your magnetic field across there, then you should be able to get a whole lot more energy out of it, if you understand what I'm trying to say here. Anybody?
Yeah.
That would involve Curie temperature, right?
Yeah.
Allowing atoms, molecules, whatever you want to say for your own thought, right? When you heat the element up, there's water inside everything. Everything. When you heat it up, we get expansion. And now you can induce it with ease, because it's all the crystal carbons and salts are at their furthest point away from each other. Right, and the water is expanded so that they could be induced. That's how we make permanent magnets, by heating it to its Curie temperature and then inducing it with a direct current. But if you're asking if a Wimshurst could have a greater output than input, 100% for sure, because it's all about your surface area. There's really no friction or cogging effect, because there's thousands of diodes. Your brushes act as diodes, and they can only go one way. And you're filling up a capacitor, so if you're filling up a capacitor, you can have a coil, and now you can have a standard LC circuit. And you can make whatever frequency you desire from there. And the amperage is always consistent, because it's direct current. It can't go backwards. So there's no cogging. No resistance. The only resistance you have is in the mechanical part of the apparatus.
Well, I'd like to see somebody make a multi-stage Wimshurst with, you know, maybe 20 discs on there. You know, 10 sets.
but you have circumference too, right?
Yeah.
Right, which is like torque as well. So if your plates are bigger, right, or your discs are bigger, you have more. What would it be? Radiance from the center to the, or the diameter to the circumference, right? You'd have more on each half of the circle.
Yes, yeah.
It would be like more torque, too. And you can design your wind source to have a certain output, too, certain cycle.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Wind source aren't that... We don't know everything about wind source. We haven't experimented with wind source. What plates, diameters, or shapes is the best to collect all the static from the air.
So, well, it's the friction, right? Like you're saying, the trivial electric effect, right? When the plate is rubbing, it's rubbing against the air. We don't see that as a friction, but it is a friction. And that's what's making the charge. So if you have more surface area, more plates, it's just like waving your hands through the air. We say there's not really any friction, but there is a friction. There's a force there. It's unseen.
Yeah. Because everything that moves has friction. We're grown up, we're born with this friction, so we don't notice it because we're used to it. But everything that moves, everything that makes a sound, has friction.
Right. If we jump in the water, then we notice it, right?
Yes, because it's a different atmosphere. It's a water.
And that's all correlation to density. Right? When we say heaven or the firmament would be the scientific way of putting it, it's different pressures. So like you're saying, we don't notice it. If you go and stick your head in a fish tank and you start flicking outside of the fish tank, it's gonna be loud. Right? Compared to if you're outside because you've been born as this, you adapt, right? You become unacknowledgeable. It's like a train going by your house every day. When you first moved in, it's like, what the heck? Why did I move here, right? And then after 2 months, 3 months, you're like, oh, the train went by? I didn't hear it. What are you guys talking about?
Right? Yeah, you get used to it. You adapt to it.
Well, I'm thinking a whole lot further. You know, I always talk about all these different anomalies for all these different experiments that we talk about, which, you know, like I said, right now, static electricity can't run your house, or can it?
It can.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think it can, and I know that let's say, for example, somebody actually built a Wimsurf-style generator that had 20 separate plates on there. You know, there's a whole lot of surface area, so you could build up a whole lot more static charge as far as I'm concerned. And with the capacitor technology that we have today, it wouldn't take nothing to get to the point where once those capacitors are filled up, then they'd have to discharge. You can only fill a capacitor so far before, you know, break down the atmosphere in between the two the terminals and, you know, arc across. Have you ever seen a capacitor arc across itself?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, well...
Yeah,
a lot of times you'll see it in Leyden jars because, like what I'm looking at your video, I got it paused on the deal, and I can see you got aluminum foil on the outside, and do you got aluminum foil on the inside as well?
No, it's salt water.
Well, I built some similar to what you got, but I used the glass as a separator, and I put aluminum inside and then aluminum outside. Well, the aluminum inside would be close enough to the lid of that deal that when that thing got fully charged up, when it was overcharged, you can literally see it arc from the one plate to the lid.
Right, that's why if the capacitors are done properly, we have oil on top of them. But Jermaine can go ahead and explain a real Leyden jar. There's only one person that me and him both know of on the YouTube or the internet that has proper Leyden jars.
Yeah. Because the real Leyden jars are made with two... They're in a sort of dielectric, which is glass. And the inside is salt water, and the outside is salt water. But the amount of salt water within the separator is the same amount as the outside of the outside of the dielectric. So the volume of water on the outside of the dielectric is the same volume of water which is on the inside. So it's equal.
Harmonic.
And so then when you're charging it, there's your imbalance.
Yeah.
And on top, the oil is there so that you don't get that discharge.
Yeah.
So that it holds back the charge.
Right.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Like if you have, like you have foil and you have salt water, it isn't harmonic. It doesn't work properly. You have
two different ambient mediums.
Yeah, two materials, two different volumes, two different densities.
Plasticity, or all of it, right?
Yeah.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, if you had the proper Leyden jars like you're talking about, there's really no limit to how many of those you could actually put in parallel with each other for one massive storage bank.
Really? I can't say that there, you know, like Tesla's bucket capacitor, you know, that's well known on YouTube and on the internet, the web as well. That is the correct Leyden jar that we're talking about. There's only one person on YouTube, what's his name? Vincent. He makes the single Leyden jars the way that we're describing them.
Yeah.
Jermaine and myself are the only other two people that I know of that makes proper Leyden jars. And if you look at the bucket capacitor, that's a proper Leyden jar.
But
many series.
Yeah, and the volume of water isn't exact with the water inside of the bottles.
Right.
So there is more volume outside of the bottles than inside of the bottles.
When we look at volume, we look at the other thing, mass. Right? So if you have, two guys that are equal in weight pulling on each other, they're never going to get nowhere. It would be perfect. Right? Back and forth. You could do it all day long. Whereas if you have a little kid, a big guy, you're just going to throw him around, right? That's basically what's happening with the volume of water inside of a Leyden jar and tinfoil. You got a big kid and a little kid. But when you have the same amount of volume, mass, on the inside and the outside, it's equal. It's harmonic.
How far apart are your spark gaps there, Jermaine?
8 millimeters. I've calculated and it's 26,000 volts.
I'll say that's impressive. So we know
made from old records.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty good size spark gap, and I wonder. Right before that thing gets ready to discharge, have you noticed? Have you ever put your hand close enough to it? Not close enough to get shocked, but close enough to feel an ion wind build up right before that snap.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I believe that you could get a lot more torque using high voltage like that. If you've ever, I know you guys have all been shocked before, but especially with static electricity, but you can feel that pressure as it slaps across your hand if somebody comes over and touches you. So there's a force right there. And the attraction and the repulsion force, the ball spinning around in that bowl right there, I honestly believe that could actually be monopolized and built into a system that had a massive amount of torque just using static energy, static electricity in itself. You know, the capacitors or Leyden jars, whichever you choose to use, that's a lot of storage potential. And once that discharges, there's a lot of pressure that's occurring when that thing's discharging. So my question would be, how many of these doggone Leyden jars do you think you could put in a row for one massive storage bank?
Yes. Look, everything is better if you have multiple of smaller things.
Yeah.
Multiple smaller capacitors, multi-plates, like with an iron core in a transformer, it has multi iron plates, right?
Yep.
I forgot the other one.
So I'm thinking, I'm sitting here trying to visualize this this setup with let's say 20 discs on there, 20 separate, basically 10 separate sets of discs on a WIMSIRS, with 10 separate sets of Leyden jars or capacitors, whichever you choose to use. The smaller ones are obviously going to charge up more rapidly.
Right, so that would be high tension, and bigger ones would be sluggish, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that would also alter your Ohm's law, voltage amperage output, right? If you got smaller ones and bigger ones, right, then you're going to have so many volts and so many amps. You don't want too big, you don't want too small, because it's all a time domain, a time factor, right? It takes that time to charge all those capacitors and then discharge. That's a cycle. Charge, discharge, cycle, right? But how much discharge is coming out of that? How much current is going to be discharged on that second, that cycle?
Yeah, but that's the thing you can regulate if you use multiple capacitors. Because if you put them in, if you put them in parallel or series, you increase the surface area or you increase the thickness of the dielectric.
Right. It's all variation. It's changes what your questions ask and where you take them, right? Your thoughts.
I'll tell you what, I discharged a few capacitors that sounded like cannons going off.
Right, and that slap effect you're talking about, that's that Z pinch or alpha pinch. If you take a can or John Hutchinson, you take a piece of metal and you put it in a magnetic field or a waveguide, you can crush it. You can split it.
Well, yeah, Russ over there at RWG Research, he made a rail gun, and he used some real big capacitors. I mean, heavy duty stuff, and man, he was getting some really impressive results out of that deal.
Yeah, perhaps dangerous.
Of course it is. I was telling you the one time I wanted to build a capacitor out of a 50-gallon drum, and everybody thought I was crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, that would be pretty interesting to see. Like, yeah.
Big old plastic 50-gallon drum. Imagine this. You got plates, aluminum plates. Let's say we make them about an eighth-inch thick aluminum plates with eighth-inch thick glass. In between each one, the plates is a separator. And then you fill it up with oil, and you have your terminals coming out of the top of the barrel. Imagine discharging that puppy.
It would be low tension, but it would have a lot of amperage. Right, so high tension would be high voltage, low tension would be high amperage. So it would have a huge bang to it, that's for sure.
Yeah, it'd be exciting. I'd have to have a chicken stick a mile long to reach across there and touch that. Hoping I didn't get whacked.
So, Justin, you know that water is being attracted by statics, right?
Yeah.
So, Shazis, do you ever heard of athlete scaling?
Yep.
Do you know why he used coral rock?
Not really.
He was searching for a certain type of rock to build his castle on, right? His structure.
Yeah.
Because coral rock has a lot of water in it. At least, that's what I think.
Yes.
There is a lot of amount of water in it.
Right. There's many ways of moving objects, right? Electrostatics being one of them. Vibration, infrasound, because of the same thing, right? If you take a sawzall, right, and you stand on a pallet and you put 100-pound or 500-pound, 1-ton rock on top of that pallet, and you start cutting into that wood, if you get it offset so it starts making a vibration, the next thing you know, you're across the driveway on top of the pallet with the rock.
with a little tiny motor.
Right. So moving objects, big objects, there's many ways of doing it. When you're saying that it's got lots of water in it, can you take your windchurst and put a bar above it and attract rock or feathers or gold or silver? Yes, you can. Because you're giving a charge to that body, filling it up, making it buoyant, creating thrust, potential difference, without heat.
Well, taking all these things that we know about the like attraction of water and different materials, Doug, I gotta push that button. I just heard you talking. Anyway, if you was gonna build a motor that had the most power, how do you think you'd go about it, Jermaine? A static motor.
Yeah. Use smaller motors, but in large quantities, linked together.
Kind of like the solenoid motor.
Yeah, like the solenoid motor you designed.
That's pretty idea.
If you have those rotors, right, with some ping pong balls on them, covered with India ink, which is conductive, and you have those two cans or tubes. So it makes that thing turn, right? Because it's being attracted and repelled. But if you link them all together, multi-stage, multiple rotors on the same axle, and maybe one in parallel, and I don't know what, but I assure you it will give a lot of torque, especially if they're offset, just like an engine.
Yeah.
To get a continuous pull and repulsion. Right?
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Potential difference. Like another topic for electricity would be vibration. If you take a piece of plastic, either dielectric, piece of carpet, whatever, right, piece of glass, and then put another piece of plastic on it, just use tape, and you vibrate that, if you touch one tape at the bottom and one tape on the top, you get potential difference. You'll see voltage on your voltmeter. So, what is electricity? We gotta look at turbioelectric, and piezoelectric, thermoelectric. Those are effects. When we look at our error, we look at plausibility. Like we look at the numbers. We don't actually look at the effects. Like when we use a galvanometer, we see the needle deflect. We actually see that. Now we understand that amperage, the amplitude coming from that apparatus.
Yeah.
Seeing the effects and looking at the effects, like you say all the time, she says, I don't give up about the numbers. Right?
Yeah.
Don't care about the amperage, don't care about the voltage, because you're trying to see the effect, what is going on. Right?
Yeah.
And when we use electrostatics, we can move things and do things like we do in our era, but we can do things that if we look back on the Egyptian pyramids and through these old pictures and of these apparatuses, we can see that there's a lot more to electricity than we even see.
Well, some really highly educated individuals out there would overlook kind of things that we're talking about. And so, you know, I get a lot of people frustrated because of what I say. But when I talk about all these different anomalies and the effects like you were talking about of what they all do, I see it in a mechanical, different, it's kind of hard to explain, but I see it. Yeah, a completely different aspect the way, you know, everybody else is looking at it, because I'm trying to see how far you could actually take this deal. You understand what I'm saying? And most folks just want to, you know, well, you know, you just can't get enough force out of this, or you got tons of different excuses why something's not possible. But I'm the kind of guy that's asking, well, what if you put this with that? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. But I highly encourage everyone to try to build a multi plate, windsurf, or false machine, or whatever you want to call it, and make a rotor that has multiple, a machine that has multiple rotors offset, and see what happens.
There's a guy out there on YouTube called Lid Motor, and he makes these little static motors out of pill bottles. And he also makes little static generators out of pill bottles. And I've been trying to get him to try to put a motor generator together to see that, you know, how much static electricity does it take to actually run that pill bottle motor. So if you could build a static motor that initially ran off of static, and you get this thing up to turning and be able to produce enough static, you see where I'm going here?
Mm-hmm,
could
mm-hmm.
it be possible to literally build a static motor that would kind of be self-looping almost?
Yeah, like I said, if you have it offset, it will start by itself. Because there is a pull or a push from every side.
Yeah.
It doesn't need a startup. It doesn't need
initial charge.
Yeah, initial charge. Yeah, or initial motion. Because it's being attracted from each side.
Well, I'm seeing. If there's anybody out there could do it, I know Lid Motor could. He's always building these doggone really super efficient little mini motors out of pill bottles once again that basically run off of Jewel Thief circuits. You know, just tiny bit of voltage to them, and the doggone things will run for a long time. You know, really super efficient motors. And also, Remstar.org has 3D printed a couple little motors like that that actually run off of really small amounts of voltage. And so with that said, you know, he's got some out there that's run for a long time, man. They're still running.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of things out there that people are, I would say, trying to achieve, but the governments hinder us from achieving our goals.
Well, I don't necessarily think it's just the government. I think it's the education system.
Well, the education system too, as well.
I put a comment on a video of Michio Kaku, whatever his name is. he's talking about the universe in a nutshell, and he's explaining, you know, what science says about, you know, the universe and how it all functions. And, you know, one of the things that drives me insane is science and NASA and all them will look out in the sky with a telescope and they'll see a little dot way out there. And they've theorized that if this dot is blinking, then that means there's something going around it. And so they can calculate up with the math how many times this thing's blinking and how fast something's going around
it,
or by spectrolysis, am I saying the right word, where you use the different color spectrums to see what types of materials are on the planet and so on?
The birefringence, the photoelectric imaging, it's like an MRI, same thing, right? Radar. All those things are all the same thing. They're all capturing what we say magnetic fields, or saying is light, right?
I'm guessing what I'm trying to say is, you know, everything in science, as far as mainstream science, mostly is all theoretical. You don't actually know, like the windsurf. We know basics, like there's friction between the atmosphere between those plates is actually helping for the exchange of electrons and stuff. But when it actually gets down in, we got some terminology that we can use, and you know, we call certain things the laws of physics or whatever. But in reality, we're all still working on theories. It's all theoretical. But as I
like you say, the laws of physics, the word gravity, what's that mean to you?
Well, to me, gravity has to do with magnetism and the whatever it is that we call electricity. Static electricity or whatever. Anyway, I put this comment on there, and I usually get these folks all riled up for saying stuff like this, but after listening to his speech for quite some time, and talking about all the different things, everything from wormholes to, you know, space and how space works and gravity and all this kind of stuff, I got a little rowdy and I said, pure ridiculousness, but it was amusing to listen to. A world explained in theory, you still haven't got a clue. So with that said, let us smash things together and see what happens with our observations. We can formulate a new theory. We will call the obvious laws of physics. The rest we will just make up as we go and call theory. Sucks to be the one paying for college. This is what makes mad science so fun. NASA groupies get real irate when you question the science, and the college graduates / students just call you stupid while arguing theory and quoting physics like mockingbirds and cockatoos. So my theory, I will call theory of the possible, wherein you stand outside the box and see for yourself what is possible and is not possible, with a try it before you deny it approach. The theory of the possible will state that what goes up does not have to come back down. For every action is a consequence, and so if I do this, then I can make that happen. With the theory of the possible, the only things that are impossible are that in which you believe are impossible, and that which you believe are possible may very well be possible, until proven otherwise by fact, or fact, not fiction. What does not hurt is not painful, as well as what is not deadly can never kill you, and so on. Humans make me laugh, so with that said, Darwin may have been onto something with the monkey thing. Okay, I have to stop now. My eyes are watering. My side hurts. It's really hard to type in this condition. No wonder science is still in the caveman era. I have work to do. Peace and love to all. That's what I posted out there. Now, that ought to get a rise in some folks. What do you think? Yeah, no.
I don't know. Everybody's got, like you're saying, everybody's got their own theory, and you know, we can't ridicule each other at all. Like, you're asking me what I think, so I can give you my narrative view. It's not an opinion or a judgment because you're asking for it. You want my introspective so that you can see the prospective, right? That would be it. I can't, you know, knock anybody at all. Like, well, yeah, try it.
My point isn't work, to knock him, Justin. My point is...
No, I know that. I know that.
It's like, there's always a reason why you can't do something. There's always a reason why nothing's ever been tried. And so with real science, you know, you test, you observe, you write it down, and so on and so forth. Well, when you quote pure theory of, you know, even in mathematical equations, a lot of math, there's some really impressive math out there. But
right.
When you're equating math to the universe because of a little dot you see out there in the sky, and you haven't actually physically been there to be able to see what's actually on that planet, you can't really test to see if what you're saying is right. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't know what's on Mars because I ain't been on Mars. I can't measure nothing. I can't physically observe it. I can't touch it or taste it or smell it. I don't know what it's made of. It could be made of cheese for all I know. You know?
That'd be pretty cool.
And so until we're actually, as humans, standing on Mars, we're just theorizing. And so everything out there, you know, the theory of the possible means you try it before you deny it. You take all these anomalies, like when I said, what goes up doesn't necessarily have to come down.
You know,
laws of physics says what's it? Newton's law that if what goes up must come down. Well, okay, if you throw a ball in the air, gravity's always obviously going to pull it back down. But if you inflate that ball with a bunch of helium, and you throw that ball up in the air, and then suddenly the ball don't come back down. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, if you take this law of physics and use it with that law of physics, you get stuff done. And that's the point I've been trying to put across a long time, especially to the NASA groupies. When I asked them questions about what type of batteries they had back in 1969, because they were pretty impressive to do what they did, they get all frustrated, like, you should already know this. Why are you even asking me? You're below me. You're beneath me, because you don't know what kind of power source they used on the moon. Well, if I don't know, then I guess it'd be a good question, right?
Yeah. Like you said, everything is questionable if there is nothing that confirms it or denies it.
Well, I think that we have the capabilities and technology to do some amazing things right now. I think that a lot of that is literally suppressed. I think that there's a lot of information out there. I mean, for Pete's sake, the American people and people around the world actually pay money for NASA to do all the research, but most of what they got, they patent and they got the money for it, but that doesn't go to, like, out here in the alternative energy community. When we find something cool, we share it with one another so that somebody else could run with that and do more research on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. If you want to if you want to make something, or if you have an idea, you need to share it, because if you're alone and you keep your ideas by yourself and the government finds out, you'll be silenced and you have no one to talk to. But if you share it, they ain't going to stop you. They can't hide it from everyone, yeah, because it's already shared. It's everywhere.
It's already out of the box.
Yeah.
That's why I like out of the box mad science. I mean, sure, I might say some things that might not sound right or might sound even crazy for that matter, but that's good, because, you know, when I go into my mad science laboratory, I'm blowing stuff up all the time. I'm catching stuff on fire and breaking stuff, and I'm seeing, if I do this to that, I get this result. Well, in the process of doing that, I'm learning that there's certain things that you can and can't do. I'm not allowing the laws of physics to define my research. I'm not allowing the laws of physics to be the boat anchor that a lot of these individuals out there do, because that's it. You know, if somebody says something's impossible and they're highly educated and you just, like, I'll take the word for it, there might be an anomaly out there that would make it possible, such as defying the laws of physics and saying, you know, when you throw something up in the air, it must come down because of gravity.
Yeah, because, like, studying is good, but if you're being taught the wrong things that hinder you in your projects, your ideas, because you're taught that certain things do certain things, and if you didn't know, you find it by yourself, and you can prove that it's wrong. Some things that you're taught at school aren't be the truth, because it's just a theory, but you're being taught that that's the way it is.
Yeah.
But if you haven't been to school, you have a free mind. There's nothing that says you can or cannot do.
Well, honestly, I would put a guy like Justin up against any college student in the entire world.
Oh yeah, that would be fun.
And yeah, the reason why I say that is because he's not limited to what the book said that you can or can't do. He's thinking beyond what you know they no. said can and can't be done.
Yeah, but he trusts the source. Like back in the day, or I don't know when, but the first people who written all these anomalies down, those are people that they're telling the truth, because there isn't anything that is false, because it was all new back then. It was the old documentaries, the old films, the old information, you know it's all right, because back then they didn't.
Science was good back in Tesla's day because it wasn't political and it wasn't where people were, you know, actually trying to monopolize all the technology, which they do today.
No, we were trying to grow and progress, flourish, flourish. See, when, like you're saying, like, I take all the old stuff. I have taught myself to read and write in Latin because it is the first language of the English language. And I don't like the English language. All the old stuff, like Jermaine's saying, I would go to pictures on the Egyptian walls, study them for hours as a child. And now I can give you all kinds of pictures and show you that all of our electrical symbols are the same. Like those are things that you gotta look at. They're on a big wall. They're not put in a drawer hidden from everybody.
No.
Well, that's why I get so frustrated with the college folks and the NASA groupies, you know, because I want to know what kind of batteries they had back in the 60s that was able to keep a man on the surface of the moon cool and in the sun and warm in the shade and so on and so forth, and be able to do that for a couple hours while he's out wandering around out there on the moon. All right, because if that kind of technology existed back in 1969, that's pretty impressive technology. So you could only imagine what we could be, what we could have access to today. And if there is a so-called energy crisis, and they're all worried about this so-called climate change / global warming / climate disruption or whatever it's going to be next week when the math doesn't add up, then why is it that we can do stuff like send a probe clear to Pluto so far away that the sun is just a speck of light in the sky, and it's been out there for over 9 years and it's still producing over 200 watts of power that's able to send pictures and video back to Earth again. You see what I mean?
As I would say, said, thank you, Tesla, for the RF range.
Yeah.
What is RF? It's sound. If we go back to Faraday and our modern electricity can't go into the cage, right? But sound can penetrate into the cage because sound goes through all matters, right? Like plasma is not really plasma, but plasma, you got liquid, you got solid, right? Electricity can't pass through all those. Plasma cannot pass through a solid. Plasma is electricity. It's a different form, if you want to say. It's a higher velocity. It has less tension at a higher velocity because of the medium that it's in. Right? When we use a plasma welder or a plasma cutter, we spray an inert gas. That inert gas is pushing away all of the oxygen, all of the resistance, so it takes less energy to get to that high tension.
And it prevents oxidation from forming.
Well, right, because like there's no oxygen in the area.
Like if you weld with aluminum, you use 100% argon, because argon it's more dense. No, it's at least it's heavier than air, so it falls down on the thing you're welding. So it shields off all the oxygen from coming in. And you use 100% argon because aluminum oxidizes quicker than iron. Because when you're welding iron, the common gas used is, I think, 75% argon and 25% oxygen, because it doesn't need to be shielded off that well, because it's more, it doesn't oxidize as quickly.
It's all about the transformations of waters.
Stephen Gibbons posted something in the chat room there that that I never even heard of before. It says Bose or Toppler Holtz machine, sometimes used at the turn of the 20th century to power X-ray machines. And it's like what we were talking about earlier, the multi-disc Wimshurst style setup.
Yeah, that's what he's making next.
Like, that's what we said. Those are the old medical things, the generators for using for X-ray tubes, for medical shocks, however you want to call it. And
right.
A question for you. Where does math come from?
Math?
Yes.
You guys still there? Hold on, I need to add Muddy. Go ahead with that answer there.
Buddhist science.
Yeah. It's...
We're live. It's, go ahead.
It's what we see and what we describe in formulas and in with words. It's something that is, or it's what is in what's in nature, but it's math comes naturally. Like if you have four or five apples and you eat two, you know that two are gone, but you still have three left. So it comes naturally because we observe things that are in nature. We see what nature does. We see what forms nature have.
Right, we standardize it, just like the metric in the imperial systems. Me to me, love those ones. Everything's defined on a decimal value. We either place it on the left column or the right column. You could do this in very many charts. It goes back all the way to the Egyptian times with the Akibas, which is a counting thing, right? Left, right, T charts. Same thing. Left, right, all of our accounting. Left, right, everything, right? We define everything on decimal value. Even our thermometer, right? Our barometers, everything else. Which is goes back to gravity, difference of potential, mass, etc.
Yeah. You got, so Justin, do you think those Egyptians used drawings and figures, symbols, to describe things that are happening before they knew how to describe the things that were happening? So they used animals, like a snake, that represents electricity, right?
Right, like a snake will bite you, right? But, like, these pictures and everything else, they come natural to us, just like mathematics, right? And that's what we're going back to. Like, if we look at the writings and how they write, up to down, right? Right to left, however it is, just like the Chinese, right? Us, ourselves, are going back to those writings. I notice it as my age, I'm 33, you're a little bit younger than me, half my age, and what do you do on the phone? Acronyms. We can have conversations with pictures now. Because that's what we've made it. Us children have made it through the years, right? Our parents say, get off those video games and this and that. We're ASL, right? Age, sex, location, everything like that. We're doing all of those things. We're creating the next new living language as us, the future. Children are the future. They're the gods.
Because if you want to describe a phenomena, things that are happening, they use nature because they already know what nature is, so they use figures, they use animals, they use symbols.
Right.
Because back then they didn't have words or, let's say, proper symbols. They used figures to symbolize the thing that was going on.
Right.
That is going on.
And the words that they did use were basic words. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la. Right? Our own things like that. Those are the words that they use. They don't use complex linguistics like we use. We define everything because everything needs to be defined and we do it naturally. But sometimes we complicate things too much.
Well, that's, I guess, my grievance with the whole mainstream education system. They're trying to make it overcomplicated. I made one of my friends real mad because one day he come over and I was explaining something to him and he's all like, "Oh, well, you just try to make it sound too simple. It ain't that simple. There's a lot more to it and all that." And he got all frustrated and stomped off and left.
Yeah, right. It's stubbornness. Just like nowadays, they want to make us dumb. They want to make us stupid because they're trying to make everything too complicated so we can't figure those problems out. Like with a car, it's all with electronics now. It's all hidden. You don't see what's going on. If your car breaks down, you don't know what's happening. So you need to bring it to an expert who knows the stuff.
Yeah, right. Not to mention they build it in layers.
Yeah, but they make it too complicated.
Yeah, they build the cars in layers. So if you need to take off a sensor, you might have to pull off half the motor just to get to it.
Yeah, it's all about creating quote unquote jobs and planned obsolescence so that you can keep the irony of money, the current, flowing. And we're all acknowledging that, hey, I want the old stuff that works. I don't want to have to go and buy it over and over. I don't care if I have to make it now. But we've allowed ourselves to make these things too complicated and have to go to a specialist or a diagnostic or whatever you'd say.
Well, I'll tell you what, that picture that Muddy, you in here yet?
No,
he ain't here yet. Anyway, that picture that Stephen Gibbons posted in there, I'm still fascinated. I'm looking at it there on the deal, man, and it's like before the 20th century, I guess, when this thing came out. So that's quite a long time ago, man. And to me, that's real science. You know, that's real physics. There's, you know, maybe somebody today probably would have some high-tech terminology to explain how that functions. But for the time frame at which they actually did that, doggone it, I lost the connection on that side there for that chat room. I wanted to read what he said on there about how... He said it must have produced between 30 to 150 kilovolts to be able to produce X-rays.
And we're talking about your hair.
That's a lot of power, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's how I got my hair, dude, just like that.
So just buy yourself a Model A Ford and you'll be set.
Yep.
Simpler. It doesn't get simpler than that.
Nope, and it was impressive technology back in its day, man. That's why...
The differential.
If I build a Wimshurst machine, I should put it in a Faraday cage?
Maybe.
And Justin dropped out.
The doggone Mercury arc rectifier, I keep talking about that, but that was an amazing piece of technology back then. I mean, they had to be able to turn... Tesla's AC current into usable DC current for Edison to run his old elevator motors, high voltage DC elevator motors. And that's what the Mercury arc rectifier did. I mean, essentially it's a diode. It's what they made. But what it really in reality is, it's a plasma reactor. It's basically turning what would have been liquid mercury, which is liquid metal, into a gas. And you know, when you put the high voltage AC in there, caused a dead short and basically heated up the mercury to the point where it vaporized inside that chamber, and you know, now you got plasma going on, the fourth state of matter. And so with that said, the energy pressure built up inside that tube was only allowing electrons to flow in one direction. But the key about the whole deal is you're getting visible light off of this thing. You're getting radiant energy off of this thing. And you're getting DC current off of that. So you're getting like three different anomalies all in one deal. What do you guys think?
Impressive, yeah.
Yeah, and that was back in the late 1800s when that thing was around. So
was it a common method for him
for switching AC to DC?
AC to DC, yeah.
Well, as far as I know, it was.
Or was it quite dangerous?
But the only danger that I can foresee in there is, you know, possible mercury poisoning if something, you know, like the thing overpressurized and exploded and you had mercury vapors in the air. That wouldn't be a very good deal. But other than that, you can do the same process using any of the noble gases today. You know, like argon or helium, xenon, whatever. You know?
Krypton.
So, with that said right there, if you get control of the high voltage, the high voltage is, you know, you can speed it up, slow it down, you can get the same exact result out of the deal. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So you can use use it to build a rectifier to turn the AC into DC.
I don't know, but something about the smell of ozone is quite nice. I don't know. Ozone has a certain smell to it.
Yeah. I enjoyed working out in my lab whenever I had the just permeated with ozone.
Yeah.
Hey, I got a question now, or basically a curiosity. You got a Wimsers machine, and you too, Shaziz.
Yeah.
How short of a mercury vapor lamp, or your basically fluorescent lamps, does it have to be to light up with a Wimsers machine?
I tried lighting up from a fluorescent tube, but it lights it up, but for a brief second, and it flickers.
Yeah, it flickers, but you can actually shorten that spark gap, and you can get it to light continuously.
Okay, that's something to try.
Yeah, basically, while shortening the spark gap, you speed up the frequency, which gives it the opportunity to light, you know, energize that gas inside that bulb continuously.
Yeah.
The flicker you're seeing is because the gap's so wide, it pulses and then stops and then builds up again and pulses and stops and so on.
Because
well, that's
it's
cool.
Because it's the capacitors charging up, discharge and building up, discharge.
So if I put a prop on a pulley and I run it down to the bottom and spin the Wimsers machine, I can have continuous light.
Yeah.
That would be sweet.
And the higher the voltage, the brighter that bulb's going to be.
Yep.
Yeah. That'd be fun.
Yeah, but it isn't the speed. It isn't the speed.
No, but see, I would love to have a copy of the machine that I'm looking at in this picture right here.
It's impressive, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's already got pulleys on there, and so it'd be perfect for what Modi's talking about. You hook that to a windmill up there, and now you're playing with power, man. And it's multi-disc, just like what we were talking about.
I don't have the internet, so somebody download it and send it to me after the show.
You gonna build it?
I don't know. I haven't seen it.
Well,
I want to.
I'm curious.
Let me see if I
can. Shaziz.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to use some records because you can get a lot of records.
Oh yeah.
But not me. Oh yeah. I know what I'm going to do this weekend.
I'm going to download this picture and send it to Muddy if I can.
What are you going to do? Maybe you're going to go through your dad's record collection and build a bunch of Wimsers?
No. There is a small shop there, a second dollar store. So you can get a lot of them for very cheap. Yeah.
Well, either way, I'd be really excited to see how that one plays out, man. Because I watched your Wimsters video there, and that thing, it was really impressive. That spark gap's pretty far apart. Mm. That's a lot of voltage.
Oh, yeah. And it gets a proper shock.
Yeah.
I used to have a chart that would tell you how far how far apart you needed to pull those electrodes before you, and what voltage would be at what distance.
Yeah, it's some 30,000 volts per centimeter.
Wow. Hell, you pull out the tubes only need to be like 200 or 300 volts.
I just posted it in Skype there for you there, Muddy.
Much obliged. Much obliged.
It's a really impressive machine. If you build one, I want one. Now, I would love to find like an original version of that. Could you imagine what the value of that thing would be these days?
Oh, no. Yeah, they're always in a nice wooden cabinet and they look nice. They have a certain feel. I like how old antique things look.
Well, back in the day, I was actually ordering stuff off of eBay, bidding on different old like wireless telegraph coils and stuff like that. And every time, without fail, like 30 seconds before the auction closed, somebody would blast in there and blow me out of the water, and I'd lose it every time. I got one deal out of the deal that had to do with the radio, and that was this nifty little thing that had a variable capacitor on it and a coil that was actually used for checking radio transmissions.
Oh.
And I actually got a telegraph button. But as far as getting the actual telegraph, the wireless, you know, like the Marconi style, and every time I tried to bid on one of those, some turkey would run in there like the last 30 seconds right before, and he'd throw a bid in there. You wouldn't have no time to get a new bid in before it closed.
Yeah.
Hey, it's brutal on eBay, man. Try
quit trying to bid at the lowest thing you can possibly get and go high, and then just enough to piss them off and make them not want to bid on it. $10,000.
Well, I was throwing some pretty good numbers out there because I wanted it bad. But, you know, I guess I didn't want it bad enough because the last 30 seconds he done blew me out of the water.
Yeah. It's a strategy, huh?
Yep.
Bidding at the last second.
It's definitely a trick. So anyway, you know, this static electricity, even though, like I said, there's a lot of different little static motors and stuff out there that don't appear to, you know, be that powerful that you could actually, you know, get some physical work done. I think properly engineered, you could literally build a electrostatic motor that would just be incredible. I'm talking about super high voltages and, you know, voltages, pressure. And so, you know, you can get work done. I mean, you're seeing it in your video. You're seeing it firsthand. You got that ball. It's moving around inside there. There's some mass to that ball. You know, have you ever weighed it out to see how much it weighed to do a little bit of math on it?
No, I can do.
You should actually weigh it out and see how much power it actually takes to move that much mass around. Give you some sort of idea, you know, how far you could take it. Have you tried making a larger aluminum ball to see if that would move too?
No, that's the thing that I wanted to do and see what's the biggest ball is, or the most weight I can spin around.
They find limitations of the thing, and then, like you was talking about earlier, building a static motor that had multiple small ones that basically turned the camshaft just like the solenoid motor.
Yep.
To actually get some serious torque out of it.
Check this out, you mean. That bowl was only so much of a size, so it only had four poles. Now, if you went bigger, had a bigger track, or heck, even if you got one of them Hot Wheels tracks and started laying all the positive coming from one side, looking like a comb, and then go to the other side, and in between each of those, put your negatives. I bet you can get a pip ball or your aluminum ball or one of your copper balls to run the whole length of the track. I think it'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, it isn't about the amount of voltage, the amount of static pull or push, because
if you have a lot of strips that are very close together, they will attract and pull away. They'll have a lot of torque, but if you have a lot of voltage, they'll just jump over, so the amount of voltage isn't the biggest amount of voltage you can get isn't always the best. Like if you have a reasonable amount of voltage, you can put the sector, you can put the strips closer together, so you get a more continuous pull push.
Well, one thing that I noticed about messing around with negative ion generators and static electricity is how far static electricity will actually travel. I mean, I got like a little TV tray that I'm using, and I was hearing this extra ticking going on that wasn't near the machine, and I realized that I had it sitting too close to the bedpost that's made out of metal. And so it's literally running the machine, plus that energy arcing across the deal, and if you touched the metal rim on the table, you'd get a shock as well. But it just dispersed itself, no problem. So that idea that Muddy's talking about, like a circular track, like the old deals, might just work. You might just have a new toy where you can run a ball around a circular track, you know, using that energy, because it just seems like it evenly disperses to whatever path it can take. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It'd be worth trying to do something like that. Might build a new little static train or something like that.
Yeah, two tracks and have a race.
Yeah.
Yeah, come on now.
Like that dude's nice to handle.
Either way, you guys up for a music break and come back in a bit?
What do you call it? Medieval electrostatic race car.
Oh. Woohoo! Yeah! Alright, let me see.
Okay.
I'm going to try to throw. Doggone it. I don't have a lot of tunes on this doggone thing. It's not a radio show per se as far as music, but. Yeah, I'll just throw this one on there. It's a long enough one. That'll give us a static. What am I talking about? I'm stuck
get
on static.
Get coffee.
Yeah. Play that song, I'm putting my boots on backwards. I kick myself in the butt over losing you as I'm walking down the street.
All right. Well, folks, you're listening to Mad Science on www.shazizradio.com. We're going to take a quick music break, and then we'll be back. So stay tuned. Peace and love, everybody.
Aw, crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it. We'll be right back.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Yeah, can you describe the ruckus, sir? you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. We've been talking about static electricity, and we've been talking about the Wimshurst put together by Jermaine over there. If you go over there to his YouTube channel, Jermaine's Experiment Lab, check it out. Subscribe to his channel for me. You know, he needs some more people checking out his stuff to keep him motivated. You know what I'm saying? The man, the young man is like really talented. He's taken all kinds of different materials that he's gathered up, recycled, and actually turned it into a working Wimshurst design. And as you sat there looking at it, he did a really good job on it, man. I was impressed. So, Jermaine, what's your next experiment going to be with that thing?
I think I'm going to leave it for now. But I'm going to start in a multi-plate Wimshurst.
Yeah, I can't wait to see that one, man.
Oh, me too. with that multi-rotor thing.
Going to have multiple Leyden jars for each set of plates, or what?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And for each... So, there are multiple Wimshursts in series. So each Wimshurst has two plates with two Leyden jars. So there are 20 or so, 20 plates, so 10 Wimshursts, 10 outputs, let's say. So there are 10 rotors, and each rotor is offset by a little. So it makes a full, full cycle.
Yeah, if you can, build you up a series of adjustable spark gaps that you could actually, set the first one far away and then the next one just a hair bit closer all the way down, or vice versa, so that you'll get multiple different frequencies of when the static discharge comes out. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I've always had a theory that if you put a little bit of resistance, like a 1 megohm resistor on one side, that would keep that one Leyden jar slightly charged, because it starts from zero after each spark and then has to build up again. And if you can keep the Leyden jars, see, most people don't know, basically it's real hard to tell which jar is negative and which one's positive. Now, if you keep one positive and one negative, then you can take them charges, seeing as they're on a separate disc, and put them suckers in series. I think that would be awesome. Oh, parallel, you need to all work and everything, but put them in series, man. I mean, wow, what kind of a voltage can you get? Just like stacking batteries.
Well, I'd be really interested to see that experiment.
Go ahead and put that the mega ohm resistors. Then it would just take the voltage. It would feed it slow enough so your cell phone could actually charge without putting it into a static deal there. Just no spark gap. Just let it build up there, and when it starts showing that it's charging, okay, keep it at that speed.
And drain it slowly.
Drain it slow. That's what the resistors do.
Okay, yeah.
I think it'd be pretty neat.
So, we got the Wimshurst style generator. We got the Van de Graaff style generator. We got the Lord Hawksby device, the Lord Kelvin device. There's a bunch of different other...
Plus machines, friction machines.
Yeah.
The Bosper ball, yeah.
Bennett's doubler. Oh boy, yeah, there are a lot, but
Free debunks.
What?
Where he's got that plate up in the air.
No, the Bennett's doubler is there are four round plates that circulate between two U-shaped plates that are cutting through the U-shaped plate. So there are four circles. So it's on an axle with four rods. There on each rod there is a circle attached to it, and they're cutting through a U-shaped bracket thing, plate, on both sides. I'll send a picture in the chat room.
Cool.
Cool.
Well, either way, the point is that you get a whole lot of different methods by which to not only pick up a static charge, but to utilize the static charge with the different atmosphere motors out there and corona motors and ion drive designs and stuff like that. So these are the anomalies that I keep pointing out all the time that I think could be expanded on to literally build the equivalent of an electric motor that run off of static energy. What do you guys think? Yay, nay?
Yeah. That'd be pretty neat. We're talking on break, man, about lighting up fluorescent tubes. You said about shortening the spark gap.
Yep.
I think that'd be neat to put it to a prop on a pulley coming down to the Wimshurst and just get some free light that way. No magnets, no coils. I think it would be awesome.
Well, not only that, by basically putting it, you can put a light bulb up on the top of that deal, on the top of your, where your Wimshurst is, or the top of your windmill up there. And try to build up some of that static charge as the blades themselves are actually going through the air. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That'd be nice, getting it by the friction of the air.
Yeah.
Thomas, about that.
Now, I don't know if anybody's ever done an experiment such as putting a fluorescent tube on a wind turbine blade before, but that would be kind of interesting to see if by that thing spinning through the air that it could actually build up enough static charge to light that bulb.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's the whole thing about thinking outside the box, you know. Maybe it sounds crazy, but, you know, has anybody tried it? That's the thing.
Yeah.
I could put a prop out there with the wind searched on the back end of that bad boy.
Yep.
Might even turn it into a pantograph. That'd be pretty neat, but you need a heck of a long rubber band.
Might even get to the point where you could build a an argon-filled propeller that build up a static charge as it cuts through the air and would glow in the dark, man. Tell me that would be cool.
Oh yeah.
Just thinking outside the box. That's all. That's how it goes here on the Mad Science Channel.
You gotta listen.
You know, there's those folks in history that said the Wright brothers would never be able to fly. Well, if man was meant to fly, God would have gave him wings and so on.
He did. He called it Boeing 747.
Yeah.
Why are people so damn stupid?
I don't know, man.
So stupid. If God meant man to fly, would have given the wings. Well, he did. Hey, God, open your eyes. He gave you a brain to think.
Well, that's why I like to push the limits of what they say is not possible. That's why I come up with the theory of the possible, man. The only thing that's impossible is what you believe is impossible. Because you ain't going to try it because you don't think it's possible. You know, laws of physics, I don't believe the laws of physics are written in stone. You know, I believe that the theories that develop the laws of physics, you know, like, for example, what we said earlier about, you know, was it Newton said that what goes up must come down kind of deal? Well, I also said, well, what if you took that same ball and you aired it up, pressurized it with helium and threw it up and it didn't come back down? Right, so that's taking a couple things that you know in physics and adding them together, and now you get something else that, you know, it doesn't mean it has to come back down when you throw it up in the air. If you understand my point that I'm trying to get to here.
Yeah.
What goes up must come down.
Yeah. Well, if it's filled with helium, it ain't coming down for a while.
Question. Goes up, must come down. What does that have to be? Only think about this a minute. For every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. So if you can have a planet with a positive gravity, is it not possible to have a planet with negative gravity?
Why not?
So therefore, if you were on a planet of negative gravity and turned loose an object, it would not fall down, which down is to the center of the planet. It would fall up, away from the planet. Am I right, or am I being really stupid here?
No, it makes sense. You know, there's a negative and there's a positive. There's the opposite side of everything, as far as I'm concerned. So,
okay.
Who's to say when you look in the mirror, you're not actually looking into an alternate universe? You're actually looking into the opposite of you.
You're looking into a reflection.
Yeah. But it could very well be that there's something on the other side of that reflection, is what I'm saying. I don't know, because everything's a theory. Everything out there is theoretical. All the science that we think we know, we're still in the Stone Age era. It's as simple as that. We know a lot, but we don't know it all. We can look at the stars and speculate on how far away that star is and what it's made of by the color of light coming off of it and all that stuff. But that doesn't necessarily make it the case. We might get over there and that doggone thing might be made of cheese. You see what I mean? Until you get there, until you actually do the experiments to where you can see, you know, like stepping outside the box and trying it before you deny it, then you won't never know. So, is it possible to make a static electricity motor that would rival the internal combustion engine? I believe it is. Literally.
I believe it. Absolutely. To me, the measure of intelligence is the understanding of how little you know.
Well, you can get... you can get motion with static electricity. We've seen it. In Jermaine's video, you watch the ball spinning around inside that bowl. There's a lot of things going on inside that bowl that don't just have static electricity by itself in play. Once that ball became in motion, now you're building up some centrifugal force. So the weight of that ball could actually, in theory, and possibly even in fact, bump into something else and cause something else to happen. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to see how far we can push static electricity, because it's so prevalent in the world. Everybody in there, everybody on this planet at some time or another has been affected or exposed to static electricity, from your brother zapping you on the ear with a lightning bolt, or from an actual lightning bolt popping in the atmosphere. And you know, if you ever watch lightning hit something, that's a lot of power, man. How many volts do you figure is in one lightning bolt?
Lot. That's a big gap. 30,000 volts per centimeter? Yeah, that's a lot.
And so if you did the calculations on one lightning bolt, and you seen the destructive power of one lightning bolt, if that ain't if a lightning bolt ain't enough to push a car down the road, then I'll eat my hat.
Hey, Doc, from Back to the Future, Dr. Brown said 1.21 gigawatts.
Yeah.
It's within a lightning bolt. So, yeah.
That was a gigawatt.
Well, I don't know, but it's a lot.
A lot. it's 1.21 times 10 power of 9. No, I don't know.
Well, either
it's
way,
it's a lot.
Let's just say it's impressive.
That was interesting.
So, imagine if you could contain the power of a lightning bolt inside an engine or a motor, you know, and the force, you know, that force has got to go somewhere. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Static electricity is impressive because, like I said, it will travel. I mean, I'm doing an experiment in the middle of the table, and I'm shooting an arc off the side of the table onto the bedpost, and able to shock myself on the opposite side by touching the side of the table. And we're not talking about, I'm not even touching the experiment itself. I'm just touching the metal surrounding the experiment, and that energy is traveling everywhere. It's pretty impressive how far static energy travels. And it's impressive on what it can actually travel to on the outer surface of all different types of materials. So if you could harness the power of static electricity, you'd literally be able to harness the power of lightning. That's the point. What do you guys think?
You've got one.
That does travel through the air pretty cool. You know, one thing I wanted to do is I wanted to hang a bunch of fluorescent tubes from one end from trees, ground them, and then walk through the, kind of like walking through the forest with a bunch of lights hanging. Take your little Tesla coil with you and walk and watch all the lights light up your path. I think that'd be awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Somewhere out there on YouTube is a video that I saw quite some time where a guy built a little atmosphere motor that he had sitting on the, had bolted to the wall of his house. And you'd see that he'd go out there during storms. Every time it was storming outside, any kind of lightning going on whatsoever was enough to start that motor spinning on its own. And so, you know, it was pretty cool to see that all he was doing is just letting a lightning storm run this doggone motor, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So why couldn't you build?
You can run that little pit ball around the track of the outside of the bowl and stuff. But when I was a kid, like 8 years old or so, man, I was a clockmaker. And I sat for hours with like a Seth Thomas 124 movement inside the clock. You know, and you'd have to have this key that you had to crank, and that would wear your arm out to wind the thing up. But over a period of a day or two, or that thing would wear it down. Now, when you got down to that spur gear or the dual escapement, it doesn't take nothing to move that. So my little thought, I sat for hours and I just took the pendulum off that, or half that dual escapement off there and just watched that spur gear move and spin, and it would spin pretty fast and haul. You know, and some guy made a little generator that you kind of put a weight on, and then, it would sit there and light up your LED in your tent while you're out there. So you just, every time it started getting low, you just pull the other string and run it back up. I always wanted to build one of those. And the other thing that, in thinking in the opposite direction, off the power of a 1.5 volt, you know, your little AAA battery, if you got all that gearing, could you actually jack the car up?
I don't see why you couldn't. Yeah. One of the things I was just thinking about when you mentioned LEDs was, Jermaine, you should try an experiment to see, you know, you got the different positive and negative plates in that bowl. You should wire an LED to that so that whenever one to the positive side, one to the negative side of each one of your deals, and so that every time that ball exchanged the electrons, it would light it up, but it would only light it up on, LEDs only allow current to flow in one direction. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so it wouldn't hit every time it hit one of the plates. It'd only hit when it hit a certain one. But it'd be kind of neat to see if you could actually get that ball, as that ball is spinning around in that bowl, to blink some LEDs on either side, depending on where that ball was. You see what I'm saying?
Draining some of the charge, right?
Yeah, when that charge is being drained off, when it's sent through there, you got actual current flow going on. So even though it's not going to be a whole lot, you know, for just the design that you got there, it should be enough to light an LED up, because LEDs only require electron flow. They don't require a lot of current flow in order to light up. You can hold
none. voltage machines.
Yeah, you could hold an LED in your finger out in the air next to a Tesla coil that's running, and that LED will light up. You're actually the ground. So if what I'm saying is right, then you should be able to hook an LED to the little aluminum plates that you got inside that bowl, one on the positive and one on the negative, and every time that ball goes around and changes electrons, that LED should blink.
Yeah.
Be worth a try.
Yeah, why not?
So, you know,
what?
Who knows? You might be able to build a LED system on the actual Wimshurst disc itself. As that thing's building up a charge, when you spin it around, those LEDs will rotate around the outside. I seen a toy a long time ago that I believe worked on the same concept. Muddy, you ever remember seeing a yo-yo that had like LED lights inside there, and when you roll it down, it'd light up, and then...
Yeah, Duncan Yo-Yo did that with the butterflies, and then they did it with the regular yo-yos.
Yeah. It'd be pretty cool to see. Anyway, something worth trying. But that's...
They had two batteries in them. Had to have them just equally. You had to set them right or your yo-yo would kind of vibrate while you're spinning it.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty neat. I'd spend all night trying to do around the world and stuff, walk around the yard and use it as a flashlight. Then I got hit.
Use it as a flashlight.
Yeah, then I saw stars.
Well, a lot of these little flashlights, like even the shake-up flashlight, doesn't take much to charge up a little capacitor. You know, so I'm thinking you could probably get a lot of stuff on a small scale, at the very least, done, you know, using nothing but static electricity. If you can store that energy, you can use it. It's as simple as that.
You see how the rotor engines work, right? I was thinking like... That shaky flashlight is like a, you know, kind of like a solenoid. And if I put a piston rod all on the same crank and I put them things in a, I put all them flashlights in a radial set and then put them on a prop out there, I'd have all them flashlights lit up.
Well,
just by moving them through the coil like when it's charging.
The magnetic ballast, it's amazing if you ever really mess around with those little magnetic ballasts. You know, those are, in order to produce high voltage in the old fashioned style ballasts, they had a primary and a secondary. Well, the newer little magnetic ballasts, they don't have a secondary on it. All they got is a primary. So once you energize that, it's that back EMF that sends the high voltage surge out. And so, you can take one of those little ballasts and you can put it on a 9-volt battery and you can put your finger down on there and, you know, energize that coil. The moment you lift up, if you still got your finger touching those wires, you're going to get a jolt out of that thing. You know, you can do the same. You can put your thumbs on a 9-volt battery and not get a jolt like that. But you put one of them coils inside there and you energize that coil. When that energy... expands that field and that field collapses, it happens so rapidly that it sends a surge out. That's the whole trick behind the Tesla coil, was that, you know, Tesla was trying to figure out why it is that every time he hit this knife switch you'd get this sudden surge and then everything would balance back out again. And I know that there's probably been a lot of you guys out there that went and turned the light switch on in the bathroom and blew the light bulb out. Because it was that sudden surge when that light came on that light bulb couldn't handle and it blew out. That's a lot of power, man. A lot more power, you know, in that tapping on and off like that. That's how you know, these Tesla coils and Slayer exciter circuits all work.
Tesla spent hours and hours turning switches on and off and on and off and on and off.
Yep. But the faster you do that, the higher the frequency, you know. And as far as the Wimshurst, you know, Jermaine's already pointed out, it don't take much RPMs in order to build up a lot of voltage. So, I'm saying you could go somewhere with this. What do you guys think?
Yeah.
I've seen them people take a relay, set it up like a buzzer, where you take the coil and the normally on contact, wire those in series. Then on the other contact, basically stick that to the coil and use that as your output coming out. And you wind up with an inverter. It's sawtooth, but it's an inverter.
Electrostatics is underrated.
20 light bulbs and stuff. Pretty cool.
What'd you say, Jermaine?
That's everyone underrates electrostatics, and that's the problem.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. You know, you actually feel a physical sensation, and sometimes I feel physical pain whenever a static discharge hits you on your hand, depending on how high the voltage is. But you can feel that snap, man. That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, it will wake you up. Yeah.
Yeah. And when
you know those flip audio transformers that go, there's 8 ohms on one side for your speaker and the other side's 1,000 ohms for coming out of op amps and stuff? Now, I was in college and I stuck the 9-volt battery to it. And the guy said, no, you can't. He said, it has to have AC. It's not. You can't do that with DC. And I said, well, touch these two wires right here. And then I connected it. He got a shock. I said, all right, it's connected. He said, touch it again. He said, oh, no. So I touched him with it, and I disconnected it. It got him just as bad.
They used to have these little novelty books that had kind of a, like, aluminum foil cover on it. And it said something about shocking stories. And you pick this book up. The moment you open it, it hits a little deal that twangs across the coil and shocks the living crud out of you. You remember seeing those?
Yeah.
They also had those little pins that when your hand is on one side of it and you put your thumb on the button and push it to, like, you know, push the pin open, it shocks the crud out of you.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, with the mouse. Where you click the button.
Yeah, that'd be a good novelty one. A USB shocking mouse. Light you up. Anyway, you can have a lot of fun with static electricity, but I think you can actually do more with static electricity. I think you can actually get a lot of work done. And since it's so easy to produce high voltage, and with the capacitor technology going the way that it's going, it's getting better. We're getting some amazing capacitor technology. The supercapacitors out there, people have been building battery packs out of these things. There's actually batteries out there that have built-in capacitors for starting big machinery and stuff. Did you know that?
Yeah, your starter winds use a capacitor.
Yeah. Well, they've been using capacitors in different motors, not just to smooth them out, but to give them that extra kick to get them going to begin with, like compressor motors.
So Also, your ceiling fans and a lot of motors that that run on AC with dual stators, they basically, those suckers have different values of capacitance to tell that, to level out what kind of power you're coming out. So the ceiling fan motors aren't taken by some ceiling fan motors have certain only so many of them coils wound on there, and then a little bit more and a little bit more on the secondary coils, but they run a different capacitor on some of them to change the speed as well. So it's the size of your capacitance. There's a formula for it. I can't quite come up with it right now, but that's how they regulate the ceiling fan motors. It's got one rectangle block in there, and it's got three different size capacitors.
Well, I think that with capacitor technology and everything that is known about static electricity and generation and so on, that this motor that I keep talking about, I believe 150,000% beyond a shadow of doubt, it's possible to build a static electric motor that would rival the internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean,
Atmo motor has a surprising amount of torque to them.
Think about the land speed record for an electric car. I don't know what the if it's been broken since, but the last I heard, it was like 245 miles an hour using nickel cadmium battery packs. Now, they weren't putting any juice back into the system. They just charged it fully up, and then they went for a run. Now, imagine if they were actually charging that system on the fly as they were going down the deal. They would have exceeded that 245, and who knows what they'd have hit. But if you had a system that you could pick up energy as you're cutting through the atmosphere, and that energy was pumped right into the heart of that machine. Can you see where I'm going with that?
Yeah.
Man, you could have a car that would exceed 300 miles an hour.
Well, a lot of your hybrids, you'll find out that they got a battery. They got a battery system in there. It's I think it's right at about 3,000 volts. The voltage is the speed of the motor, and you do your gearing and everything. That way you're not using as many amps. You won't be frying wires trying to get the wattage out. It's your voltage times your amps.
Yep.
You know, the only way to get that doggone kind of power out without heating up a bunch of wire due to amps and having to spend heavy wire is basically raise the voltage. So they're running some high voltage on them things.
Yeah, and
some
that,
of them get up 300 miles.
That point you just
not
made...
power. Miles.
That point you just made could actually go further because, you know, when you're running these static generators and stuff like that, it's producing a lot of voltage, but nothing's getting hot. So imagine an electric motor that ran off of static energy. You wouldn't have to worry about, you know, only friction that I can see of anything getting hot would be the bearings in any moving
pretty
parts.
Cool.
You see what I mean?
Nope.
But,
yeah.
Man, if you had a motor that could run like that, I mean, top speed, as long as you had it on, just keep on running, you wouldn't have to worry about it breaking down because friction is the worst enemy of a machine. It starts wearing out parts, tearing into stuff.
The way those Atmo motors, I'm suckers, but it's a high voltage machine. It doesn't run very many amps.
Imagine an Atmo motor on a magnetic bearing system. Frictionless bearings.
With a gear up system.
Yeah.
Or gear down. You can jack the car with static electricity.
Have you heard of magnetic coupling for transmissions?
Yes.
So, essentially, you ain't got no direct, it's not directly bolted, it's just using a flywheel system to turn another rotor that has magnets on it. By spinning those magnets past there, you're spinning the opposite magnets as they're trying to get away from the magnets as they're flying by. But, you know, by itself, it don't seem like that big of a deal, but when you start adding in centrifugal force and tip speed of whatever diameter the disc is and stuff, it starts to get impressive. If you understand what I'm trying to say.
That's right.
So, think about that and the hydrodynamics, you know, like how a torque converter and a clutch works, you know, or an automatic transmission that, it spins that fluid up, and that's what engages the clutches. It creates pressure inside there that forces those clutches to engage. And it's enough centrifugal force, and the weight of that fluid inside that deal is enough to pull that. You know, what's the average car weigh? 3/4 ton?
Let's see. I crushed a few of my taxi cabs. Those were Caprice Classics. Let's see.
Average car weight about
26,000 pounds. And things about 2,000-3,000 pounds.
All right. Well, so you're able to move a 2,000 or 3,000 pound vehicle with whatever you're carrying and yourself inside of it down the road using hydraulic pressure inside a clutch system inside of a torque converter. You're converting energy from the motor itself to hydraulic pressure that is engaging the clutches inside there, and making it work. It's kind of like the centrifugal clutch of the go-karts and stuff, you know. When you get that thing, it won't engage until you get it up to enough RPMs that the weight actually expands out and grabs a hold of the outer deal on there. So you got a basically a neutral where you can lower the RPMs and stop. It's a lot of physics involved.
Yeah, there was
involved,
a guy named Wade who worked at Vigian, which is a smaller wind turbine. Not a wind turbine, but a wind tunnel. Just outside, just across the street from NASA, just outside the gates. They did a lot of the smaller experiments and everything for NASA. Now, Wade sold me two tape drive motors, so I had a matching pair of them. He told me if I got four of them, I'd wind up with enough to move one of my taxi cabs, which were Caprice Classics.
Cool. Well, also, that deal that we were talking about earlier about Tesla flipping that knife switch over and over and the surge of power that comes out of that, that surge of power also works with water as well, hydraulic pressure. Have you ever noticed how, like, whenever you very first turn on the garden hose, how it squirts a lot farther than it does when it finally balances itself out? Well, the same thing works mechanically on that clutch. When that clutch is engaged, that's why you don't want to stomp the crud out of an automatic transmission all the time, because you get that sudden surge, which you can squall the tires and people like. It's cool, but you'll start eating into that transmission because there's too much torque being transferred from one point to the next by stomping on the gas.
And you got a stack of clutches for all your different speeds.
Yeah.
And you start tearing those down, just kind of like brake pads. You start putting that torque, that thing slip and wear your transmission down. That's why people don't understand, man. You see them out here at the red light, and they pour that thing every time that the light changes. And they waste that energy by stomping the brake at the other end.
Yeah. No wonder why their transmissions don't last long.
Right. Now, my wife, she did the paper route, man. She had a 2013 Jeepski Patriot. And within the first year, it's an automatic 7-speed transmission that learns to adjust according to your driving habits. So that's a pretty expensive transmission. She wore it out in 10 months, got another one with a brand new warranty on it. Before we lost the vehicle, it was on the way out again. So, yeah, she'd like to see how fast she'd get the paper route done. What normally took me about two and a half hours, she tried to do it in an hour and a half.
Hmm. Well,
that worked out pretty quick.
If you can do that with hydraulic pressure with water, you could also do that with pressure from the high voltage and static electricity, because when that, like I said, that's why I keep asking people, have you ever put your hand near the spark gap right before that discharge? You'll literally feel an ion wind build up as that power is building up behind there, and then you see it as the spark goes across there, you hear that big old snap, that acoustic wave that's coming off of that when that power discharges across to the other side. So you can audibly hear it, you can visually see it, and if you got your finger in the way, you can feel it.
Yeah. I always wondered, man, you make that Wimshurst machine, you put some real tall Leyden jars, making the same, just like tubes instead. It take longer to charge that up, but I tell you what, when it discharges, you ought to have a little bit more amps, and you should get a pretty loud pop out of that, sound like a firecracker going on.
Well, yeah. On the timing issue, even if you got a large capacitor bank, and if you think about it on how I explained that, that system where you got Olympic-sized swimming pool that holds water, and then all the other systems below that are just a bit smaller, all the way down to your tiniest one, which would be a bucket or maybe even a Dixie cup for that matter. As long as you keep dumping energy into that large one, all the ones below that are going to remain full. As long as that large one doesn't go completely dry, everything below it's going to remain full. And so if you got a Wimshurst that's continuous, you start it up, let's say you start it up a half an hour before you need any of that power. You start it up, it charges up that big bank, fills up all the little ones down the hill, and all you got to do is just keep a steady flow of energy going into the large bank, and all the loads that you want to run will remain full, being able to be able to use them on demand. You see what I mean?
What you mean? You mean putting diodes from the big one to make sure the little ones don't discharge?
No, you don't have to. It's all pressure. The smaller ones are going to fill up faster. You can actually use capacitors to time out circuits because the smaller ones with less volume, they'll fill up faster than the larger ones. You could have the same amount of voltage equivalents for a large capacitor. It might be a 12-volt capacitor, so many farads or microfarads or whatever. And then you could have the equivalents of the same capacitor, but in a smaller capacitor. That smaller one will fill up faster. And so that light will come on first. Once it gets up to its full potential, able to break across and light that LED, it'll light that LED up. And so I've actually made circuits that have absolutely no transistors in them. All I used was capacitors, different size capacitors that would charge up at different rates. And the smaller ones would come on first and the larger ones and so on down the line. So you could actually build blinking capacitor circuits with absolutely no transistors whatsoever. And all you're doing is using the capacitors themselves as timers. You see what I mean?
Yep. That's how a lot of them electronic timers work. They build up, depending on the size of the capacitor, would tell the blink rate.
So you can actually guide that power where you want it, when you want it, by using the volume that those capacitors can hold. You know, they're all the same voltage. They're all pretty much the same microfarad range. One of them's just smaller than the other. And the little one's going to fill it up the fastest, obviously. So if you can think about, like, from large to small, let's say you got 10 capacitors, one's a huge one, right? And then you got a little tiny one at the other end. When you put your charge to that deal, it doesn't matter which end you're charging from, that little one's going to charge faster. And that pressure is going to continue to go until all of the capacitors are full and begin to discharge themselves. But if you're starting off at the big side and you're filling that up, it's draining downhill to the smallest capacitor. So as long as the large bank is completely full, then as long as it ain't completely empty, then everything else, you know, all this energy is draining downhill. It's all going from largest down to the smallest, and the smallest one will be the last bit of energy and the last blinking LED. All right, now that's proven fact. I've already done it multiple times. I've done lots of videos that show that process in there. So if I want to time it out like you do on your cylinders, you know, when you get your distributor sending it to number one first and then to this one over here back and forth, I can time it out because I want the energy to go somewhere first. I use that smallest capacitor because it's going to charge up first and it's going to discharge into the other. You see what I mean? Then the next one in line, next bigger one, goes to the next one, and so on down the line. So you can actually guide this energy where you want it to go, when you want it to go there. What do you think?
That's pretty cool.
And if you're energizing it into coils to pulse a coil, like the magnetic ballast, when it discharges into that coil, that field's going to expand. Well, at some point, it's also going to collapse. When it collapses, you dump some of that energy back into the system again. So, you know, you're basically, all you're doing is bouncing energy around. You're moving it back and forth. Throw nature off balance, and nature slaps back with a vengeance. That's why when you got a switch there, all that energy is built up behind there. It's looking for a place to go. And you got an empty side on one side of the pipe and you got a full side on the other. The moment you open that gate, it rushes in and you get that sudden surge until everything levels back out again. That's where Tesla's genius was in that, the way that the Tesla coil worked. And same thing applies with static electricity. You feel that pressure build up before it ever even discharges. And it's a lot of pressure. So.
Yeah, I think it was on part four or part five sealant band wind turbine.
Yeah.
Sat there and I ran across the dial bridge rectifier and I had a little transformer from a stereo. And it showed 12.9 volts. Now you figure the diodes, they were 0.7 volts breakover. So with the two, that you have to run through in a dial bridge rectifier, you wound up, with a 1.4 voltage loss. But that's only true when you have a load on. That's what the load is for regulating. Which is nothing but a resistance to allow just so much current to go through. Now, if you put too big of a load, it would drop the voltage on the transformer and on the diode. But the difference that you would see was actually 1.4. But if you had nothing on it, both sides, you'd have the same AC voltage on the transformer as you would on the DC side on the other side of the rectifier because there's no flow. So it doesn't show, and it doesn't even register. That's why I was saying if we throw a resistance, say off the Wimshurst machine, off the Leighton jar capacitors, you throw the right voltage across there, or the right resistors on there, you're going to wind up, you can only get so much power through it, so therefore you could actually step down, and as the battery's charging on the, like on your cell phone or whatever you're trying to power with it, you can get that voltage down to where it'll accept it. Especially like LEDs, they won't conduct until they get to a certain voltage, and once it gets to that voltage, yeah, just going up, 1 point of a volt or 2 points of a volt, the current flow goes up. It's not a need. It's a non-linear, your diodes are non-linear devices, so your LEDs are the same. That's why with the, I bypassed the rectifier on one side. I had two rectifiers for coil one and coil two on the sealant band wind turbine. So I had two rectifiers and I just wired two legs together and then I took it off the AC side. And I'd wind up lighting up my AC strands of, I had 12 strands of the 120 volt AC Christmas light LED displays. I had 12 strands of those and they would light up really nice. As soon as I took it off the DC side of the rectifiers, now it would slow the blade down. I'd wind up just hooking up to a 12 volt battery and that would drop the voltage and the LEDs did not conduct at all, so I was amazed at the versatility of it.
Yeah.
Going in and hook it up to the 12 volt battery and it would drop the voltage, so therefore the LEDs went out as soon as I hooked it up, and if I wanted the lights on, I'd just disconnect it from the battery and the voltage would go back up. So, I mean, the resistance and all, with the battery being the voltage regulator, it went down and tried to convert everything to the amps to go into the battery. When I disconnected it, the LEDs were the voltage regulator. And I seen when the windstorm got up there, it got above 120 volts. It was up around 140, and I had to plug my laptop into the end of the LEDs.
120 volt.
Yeah, and that brought it down there to 125, and I didn't blow any of my LEDs just because I plugged the laptop into it.
Well,
so the resistance can regulate any voltage. So I'm thinking with a Wimshurst or even, you know, just about any static like Lord Kelvin's device, I'd like to show, you know, charging up the doggone cell phone or whatever you got to charge up, even a 12-volt battery.
Well, we're down to the wire again. We're at the end of the whole deal, but one of the things while I'm thinking about listening to what you were saying about charging on there, I started building my Tesla coils in layers where in between each turn, you know, like one full turn's of wires all the way up, in between each layer of coils, I had a capacitor layer. And those capacitor layers would be connected to the next coil in line that whenever there was a little short spark gap inside there, that whenever the radiant energy charged up that those aluminum plates, which were the capacitors I put in between there, it would pulse the next coil in line and cause a domino effect. And so I'm thinking you could probably do the same exact thing with a Wimshurst style generator, or even Van de Graaff, or any of the static generators, because you can hold a heck of a charge with static electricity. You know, even a battery, even a car battery, after a car battery won't run like it normally does, as long as the plates aren't collapsed inside there, it could be completely bone dry, and you can use that battery as a capacitor. You understand what I'm saying?
Yep.
Yeah.
So, some of these gizmos that I put together with these capacitor layers, you got to be careful, because even after you shut the machine off, that thing's still charged up. It'll hold a heck of a static charge inside that capacitor layer. And I had some of these coils that I put, the one I put together that I called Fat Boy. That's the only one that scares me. That thing, it's got a lot of power, man. That's dangerous.
By high voltage flyback capacitors in the back of the television sets, I think those would be great for the experiments we do.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we got to get up out of here. Appreciate it. Everybody listening in on the Mad Science Show, stay tuned for the Knights of the Round Table tomorrow. Same time, same channel. But if you're listening in, go over there and check out Jermaine's experiment lab and check out his Wimshurst design. I'll tell you, when you find young men like this that are talented, you need to encourage them to see how far that they can take this stuff. That's what mad science is all about, being outside the box and not being held down by the laws of physics. Now, we're not necessarily trying to violate the laws of physics, but what we are doing is basically using the laws of physics the way we want them to be used. You know, it's like the lens effect or any of the other deals that, you know, the what goes up must come down. Who says it has to come back down? You know, fill it up with helium and because of another physics deal, it just rises because the gas is lighter than the atmosphere around it. It goes up. You know, you can fill a balloon with hot air. No helium, no hydrogen, nothing. You can fill it with hot air, and it will make it lighter than the atmosphere out there. Am I wrong?
Nope.
That's right. I believe you can.
Yeah. So, that's how them hot air balloons work, man. They got a big burner that blows up inside that canvas or whatever they got the material they use for the hot air, or, you know, the balloon. And they fill it up every so often. You know, when it starts to cool down, they'll start to go down, and they'll hit it once or twice with the burner and put some more hot air up in there, and the thing rises up again. So you're using physics, heating, expansion and contraction of atmosphere in there to actually cause this balloon to fly. You see what I mean?
Yep.
This is what I'm talking about. That's the outside-the-box kind of thinking that got people flying around in balloons and airplanes and, you know, spaceships or whatever, you know. And so this is why I aggravate the heck out of the college graduates and college-educated people out there, because I want them thinking outside the box. I don't want them just believing that the only thing you can do is what you read in a school book. Because if that's the way you got it, you already set limitations on yourself, or if it is possible, you'll never know because you never tried it. What do you guys think?
Yeah.
That works.
All right, folks.
I had one of tube-type televisions, man. I tell you what, that CRT's got some nice voltage. It's kind of dangerous to play with, but take a sheet of aluminum foil and put it on the screen. It will stick. But it'll flatten out, boy. But if you touch that thing, it will knock you for a loop. So, something to play with, or let somebody, you know, laugh at them as they walk by and try to peel it off the screen so they can see what's on TV.
Yeah, so. And for all the new experimenters out there coming in and starting to experiment and explore, be careful about old microwaves and old TVs and stuff, because those capacitors can still hold a charge. They don't always go dead whenever you shut them off. So, you know, with that
you need a source to run something, sheet of aluminum foil on the front of a television means you don't have to do any modifications and you could extract the high voltage.
Yeah.
But just, be careful.
Just practice electrical safety. Don't learn about electrical safety by accident. So, thanks again, Jermaine, for sharing your video there on the Wimshurst, and thanks, Muddy, and Justin, wherever you went.
He's gone to sleep.
All right, well, peace and love, everybody. Take care. You've been listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. Jump over there to the chat room and say hi to folks. Peace and love. Take care.
Aw, crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Is going on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.